Good afternoon and welcome to the first panel of this year's Frieze Talks programme. I'm Sam Thorne. I'm an associate editor of Frieze magazine. The subject of this afternoon's panel is technology and how it affects the ownership and, by extension, creativity in a digital era. Before we begin, I'd like to introduce my panel, beginning from my immediate right. Thomas Demand is an artist who lives in Berlin. He's had solo shows at, amongst others, Serpentine, Mumok, and MoMA. And last year, he was the subject of a retrospective at the Neue Nationale Gallery in Berlin, which has since toured to the Boymans in Rotterdam. His collaboration with the architect Caruso St. John is currently showing at the Venice Architecture Biennale, and he's also recently curated the show La Carte d'après Nature, a group show about landscapes and the legacy of Magritte at the Villa Paloma in Monaco, which is currently on. Kazis Van Ellis is director of the Network Architecture Lab at Columbia and co-founder of the Conceptual Architecture Group, AUDC, which published Blue Monday in 2007. Other books he has edited include Networked Publics and The Infrastructural City, both of which focus on recent changes in telecommunications and demographics on cities and contemporary culture. He is currently producing The New City Reader with Joseph Greimer for the exhibition The Last Newspaper, currently showing at the New Museum. And his forthcoming book is titled Life After Networks, A Critical History of Network Culture. Geeta Dayal is a Boston-based critic and journalist who has written and lectured extensively about the extensions between music, visual art, and technology. Her first book, Another Green World, about Brian Eno, was published by Continuum last year, and she's currently researching a second, which is tracing India in music from the 60s to the present day, so looking at everybody from Alice Coltrane through to disco and electro. So before we begin, I'd just like to say, obviously, turn off your mobile phones. We're going to be talking for about an hour, and then there'll be time for 15 or 20 minutes of questions from the floor. Before we do begin, I'd like to briefly outline some of the issues that I hope this discussion is going to touch upon. Who owns images? It's becoming harder to keep images in check. A lot of this has to do with the technology that we're all incredibly and increasingly familiar with, smartphones with digital cameras or editing suites on laptops, Flickr, Facebook, file sharing. This list goes on, and it's hard to believe that 6 years ago YouTube didn't even exist. Our daily lives are kind of based on this unregulated flow of images and information. And in the digital era, it seems that combining, re-recording, sharing, and stealing are kind of the norm. So what kind of implications does this have for the production of culture today? Well, first, it's clear that the distinction between production, distribution, and consumption are getting massively narrower. We're all casually involved with all three of these things, I mean, almost absent-mindedly on a day-to-day basis. In his long-tail lecture, artist Mark Leckie calls this hybrid figure a prosumer, part consumer, part producer, all of which means that copyright law in the digital era is kind of disputed and quite complex. The proper function of copyright law is obviously to regulate culture, to protect the commercial life of creativity. But now there's a big gap between what the law permits and what mainstream technology kind of allows for. Appropriation is now much easier, and new technology and outlets encourage this. It seems that lawmakers today are kind of struggling to keep up. As we drag an image from found online into a PowerPoint presentation, for example, few would consider this theft or even remotely subversive. The strategy of appropriation that artists like Sherry Levine, re-photographing photographs by Walker Evans or Richard Prince's Marlboro Men, is now extremely common procedure. Some of the power of the work of the pictures generation depends on a deeply embedded sense of ownership and authority that today seems, I think, best, you know, quite muddy, quite complicated. The same goes for artists like Dara Birnbaum, whose video work from the late 70s, the strategies of isolating and manipulating images from then-current TV shows, is now really in the hands of teenagers just about everywhere. This kind of institutionally sanctioned practice of the avant-garde of 30 years ago is now happening online. So the impulse of all media today seems to be towards a kind of intensified collage. Collage here isn't just a style, it's the dominant methodology. And it's worth noting that a lot of these terms that we're using to discuss these kind of techniques and strategies, things like remix or post-production, re-edits or sampling, they're actually things that derive from the music world. They were used to talk about hip-hop and dub and disco, and that's, I think, something we'll come to later on. But these techniques now aren't limited to home users. It's becoming more of a kind of logic for public institutions. And so where does all of this leave museums today? I think for the moment, at least, they seem a little bit confused. One example is the Guggenheim's biennial that opens next week, which is titled YouTube Play, a Biennial of Creative Video. It opens, I think, simultaneously in all five Guggenheim museums, as well as online. But legitimizing adjective in the title there, creative, signposts, I think, some of their anxiety. And it's kind of noteworthy that of the panel of selectors, it's only the chairperson, Nancy Spector, who's actually a curator. Apart from that, it's a mixture of indie bands, filmmakers, and artists. So I wonder what this says about institutional judgment when applied to online practice. The idea of professionalized selection is surely antithetical anyway to a mass participatory platform such as YouTube. And I think maybe something like UbuWeb is a counter to this in terms of a curated online archive. In the art world, even works that are produced in media that allow for mass reproduction are only made in small editions. In the age of digital reproduction, there is a great stress placed on the viewing copy as a means of granting access to the work beyond the official limited edition, a copy given or loaned to colleagues for research purposes perhaps, but which is not shown to the public. Art historian Sven Lutterken has written about the eccentric status of this semi-secret artwork. I own stacks of these kind of viewing copies, but while they're basically indistinguishable from the official original versions, they're somehow illegitimate. Artificial scarcity is used, understandably, by commercial galleries as a means of producing value, meaning that a copy is identical to the original, is actually valueless. So finally, what do official archives, public institutions, and private collectors do with a model that encourages contamination, borrowing, and stealing? Perhaps all we can say is that the art system is very elastic, it's endlessly accommodating. Perhaps if we look to the late 60s, when the art object began to worryingly dematerialize, what started being collected instead was the documentation. Will this continue to be the case today, when the physical tokens of production, DVDs, books, etc., have disappeared? Where did the conflicting models of distribution and ownership leave cultural producers and institutions today? So I think I'd like to start with Thomas. Is that okay? Or Kazis? Makes more sense? Kazis. So a lot of your own writing is dealt with this, what you call network.
I'm glad not to go first. But.
Okay.
But we've already hooked up the laptops.
Sure. Okay, so networks, publics, network cultures, something you've written and researched extensively. I was wondering if you could perhaps give a few words.
Yeah, so are we going to switch over to the display at this point?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. So we'll go for about 5-10 minutes?
Yeah, that'd be great.
There we are. All right, so of course this is one of the series of photographs that Richard Prince created that were called Untitled Cowboy. Obviously, Sam has already introduced it. And discuss the whole the idea that under postmodernism there was this interest in appropriation that was still, I think, very much based on authenticity, that this kind of work where you frame this ad and then reprint it and display it in a museum, sell it in a gallery, only makes sense in a world where appropriation is not every day. I think that this kind of work to someone who may be growing up in what I call network culture, and I'll elaborate on that in a minute, might be completely unfamiliar to them why this would be in any way shocking or in any way strange. But I show it for one reason too, just so we could have it up on the screen, and also because it does begin to introduce these sort of issues of digital rights and copyright. And in fact, I wrote an essay for, I had a minor grant to write an essay for a network book on networked art that turbulence.org put together. And I was really, you know, very, very honored to be part of that. And they were, they had received a grant themselves from, I believe, the National Endowment for the Arts to do this. And, you know, we naturally wanted to illustrate it. And because there was a bit of money involved, we felt we should actually contact all the artists. And I wanted to, you know, to show this work because I thought it was really seminal and crucial. And of course, you know, I found it on the internet. Now, when I show you the next image, you should know that this image may or may not be by Richard Prince. It could actually be, because I might not have copyright clearance for it, as you'll find out I don't, what I could very well have done is I could have actually asked my ever-capable assistants to take an exact same photograph from the original image. In fact, I wouldn't even need to do that because my partner in AUDC, Robert Summerall, has worked with as he's a production designer and he's worked for the Marlboro Man campaign. So it's absolutely, you know, absolutely easy for me to reproduce this image without even needing Richard Prinz. But that said, when I was looking for the image for this essay, I found, you know, many images just like this one online, and thought, well, you know, if they're already, you know, just Google this thing. There are a dozen of them. But I thought I should still write them. And, you know, this is what happened. This is the little message I got back. Dear Mr. Varnalis, I hope this finds you well, and thank you for your email. I regret that we are declining your request for the use of the attached cowboy photograph to be used on the Turbulent site and within your forthcoming internet book. Many thanks, all the same, for the inquiry and best wishes for every success, the poor Prinz studio manager. I thought that this was already quite odd, you know, and if anything, you know, especially because, you know, Richard Prinz is well known for the controversy that Sam Abell, who's the original photographer of the Marlboro Man ads, has complained that he sold these things for about $500 to Philip Morris. Philip Morris owns the copyright, and for some reason, I suppose because it's good advertising, and it would lead to bad publicity, has not sued Richard Prinz. You know, the thought of tobacco company suing artists is bad enough. And Sam, meanwhile, can't sue him because he doesn't own the copyright. He can just be indignant about it. So, you know, it just begins to point to some of the complications we're dealing with in this world of digital rights. The other thing that, or let's say rights today, because I think that actually speaking of digital rights both narrows things in too much, and also suggests that perhaps the digital or new media are still somehow isolated or a ghetto. And I don't think they are. As I'll say in a minute, I think we live in a culture where these things are pervasive. I think that what I would really think we should be talking about today is this issue of value. That is, that how do rights intersect with value? Because obviously that's why we have rights. How do we value work? And these are, of course, Solowitz certificates that I find very interesting because they're almost like a stock certificate. In fact, maybe not even almost. They are like a stock certificate. They're certificates of authenticity that you need if you want to produce a Solowitz. They, in fact, have the instructions for doing so. It's not the Lewitt that's authentic. It is this certificate that has it. And again, what I'm trying to point to is this problem of value in art. How do we value art? What is it that makes an artwork in the world today, in a world that in which handicraft continues to exist, but in which it's also complicated by other works that are, say, photographic, reproductive, digital, relational, and so forth? How do we value these things? Now, when we speak of the prints, we're speaking very much, again, of postmodernism. And the book that I'm working on now, I'm trying to do something which the postmodernist theorists tell us we are not supposed to do, even though they, of course, did it, being of a generation that like to put the final word on things. And I'm suggesting that we live in a culture that I call network culture. I mean, that we live in a fundamentally different condition. It's been 30, even now 40 years since postmodernity really began to come together as a concept. I mean, when you're reading people like Frederick Jameson, you know, Hal Foster, they're talking about, Andy Warhol. And, I mean, these people are my teachers. They're incredibly bright. Their work is incredibly valuable. But, you know, we're talking about work that is now of an entirely different generation, even two generations away. And, you know, when I speak to my young students about this, they have, and by young, I mean 25, 28, they really don't understand the milieu that existed back then. So I think we need to begin trying to theorize and articulate what is it that makes our world different. And I think one of the things is that, you know, the technology certainly is huge. I mean, look at all of us. We're sitting here with our laptops in front of us. You are probably wondering why, you know, you have to listen to me and you're like beginning to think about Twittering something or check your messages on your email. You know, this is pervasive. This is a big difference. But there are other changes as well that are, you know, this technology comes into a milieu that already that accepts it. As a very simple example, this is a model of this is a circle of friends network. It's what websites like Facebook and MySpace are made on. And it's actually a sociological a sociological model that was developed by in the 90s to explain the way people interact with each other. So in other words, that these websites were based on a mathematical approach that was not inherently technological, but was already being developed to understand how people were relating. And now, of course, it's exacerbated because we have the network, the effect of these sites and so forth. So again, saying there's technology, but there's more too. And again, as Sam said, we now live in a culture of copying, a culture in which appropriation is now absolutely taken for granted or even normal. It's something that artists, I mean, look, artists have always been collectors. My father is a painter. He's 93 years old. He's been a collector since he was in his 20s. He displays his art along with his collections. But we can collect differently. We don't need objects. In fact, I aggressively try to do away with objects to live in a more minimal life, and always seem to fail. But let's take a look at the way that young artists are using objects or collections today. Like, this is Daniel Etuk, who is a British artist and designer who also worked with someone who goes by the name of Vaska to develop a web content management system called Index Exhibit. And Index Exhibit is used by many, many young artists today for portfolios. And it not only is something that artists put their own projects on, but it helps them collect. So in this case, he's collecting images of car batteries. You can look on Tumblr as well. You don't have to be an artist today who works in new media to use Tumblr. I have students from Columbia's art program who are in my courses, and they're painters, but they have no problem putting their work on Tumblr. It's natural for them to have a blog. They produce their work for the internet because they want to get to you, to the people who come to this fair, and they know they can do that, even though they're stuck in Morningside Heights in New York City. And yet, they're painters, say, or sculptors. And again, so there's this kind of divide. It's different. And they, too, also use these tools to begin to collect, to begin to look at other art. And of course, in art, there is a great deal of interest in appropriation today. Again, it's taken for granted. You can do many more interesting things, I think, with art than with this new technology. This is Oliver Larrick, an artist whose work I'm quite fond of, 787 Clip Arts. Now, clip art, of course, by its definition, you can reproduce without any kind of rights issues. But at the same time, I think he's done something quite clever and fun. And this speaks a bit of this notion of remix in art. But there are also some virtues, let's say, to copyright. I'm not going to be completely against it. Let's take, this is the work of Cedric Delceau, who I love, and he's a Parisian photographer, and he's trying to photograph the banalities of suburbia and the world around him. Perhaps, like Thomas, he felt that at certain point he couldn't just reproduce that world. He had to do something to it, to make it, to defamiliarize it. In his case, though, what he did was he began introducing these elements from this, basically our prime mythological cycle, which is Star Wars. And he wound up having to contact, or Lucasfilm wound up contacting him. And in fact, George Lucas has wound up being a big fan, and I'm very proud that I'm going to be in a little book of the writing an essay for Delceau, and so is George Lucas. And it's like, all right, that's serious for me. I can talk to my 7-year-old and my 5-year-old about that. For Delceau, it's great because, now he's got this exposure and Lucas is a fan. But at the same time, I think Lucasfilm is very aware of this. Their website, theforce.net, really does promote fan art. And I think fan art is a huge thing that, is just very, very big in popular culture. And Delceau is a kind of, let's say, high art fan art, if you will. But it could be a problem because Lucas might, if it was Disney, he might have a very, there might have been a very different situation. Now, in my case with AUDC, just a couple of quick images. We didn't really struggle with copyright, but we were sort of provoked when we were doing a project on the Muzak Corporation by the idea of how do we include Muzak's imagery, and because they did have these amazingly graphic produced albums. And in doing so, we found that actually it wasn't really the issues of copyright that bugged us. It was really the fact that because Muzak is already so nostalgic and conveys certain ideas, We wanted to get away from copyright because, I mean, copyright, we wanted to get away from reproducing anything of theirs because it would become insipid and nostalgic. So whether it was their graphic design or our image of what Muzak's corporation might have looked like, which has nothing to do perhaps with really what it was like, but really was just an extrapolation of what Muzak might produce, we did produce our own images. But again, this was as much a question of our own desire as it was a question of copyright. A couple of last images here. This one, I know that you know we've all heard about the sex room at Frieze, right? I mean, if you haven't, you know there's a room you can go. I don't know where it is. I haven't been there yet. It's after the talk, but you know you can go there. You can have sex, and so I'm going to show you. I'm showing you pornography, so you aren't going to be. I know you won't be scandalized. This is an artist who I like and who I feel bad hasn't gotten the kind of attention I think he deserves. John Haddock, it is at the website silverlead.net or .com or something. And anyway, John Haddock is an American artist operating out of Texas, I think, if I'm correct. And he has done a lot of work with Remix and with appropriating images. In this case, he's both appropriating copyrighted images. This is a work of pornography. He's also not so much remixing them as using them to erase the pornography rather clumsily with a Photoshop rubber stamp tool. And I get what I think that is useful in this is not only to point out how he might be working with this sort of approach, but it also points again to this crisis of, to what we're really dealing with is a crisis of value. Because pornography has always been a kind of leading indicator for culture, at least since the 70s. You know, it is why VHS took over, not Beta. It was the first industry that was profitable on the internet. And throughout the 90s, everybody said the internet porn is the only profitable industry. And in many ways, it is a kind of, you know, it's a trade in imagery, right? Just as art is. And when we think of postmodernism was very much a moment of the rise of the culture industry, very much a moment of the permeation of art by the market and the permeation of the market by art. Today we're dealing with the fall of the culture industry. The culture industry, you know, the middle class of media, the world of reporters, of writers, of photographers, this world is getting eviscerated by the gruesome efficiencies of the net. The problem isn't just piracy. The problem is that we're having a very tough time finding a way to make a financial go of this. Art may still be booming, but you know, be careful with that. You know, just think of just a few years ago, Barnes & Noble and those kind of bookstores, these mega stores. It seemed like the golden age of the book, and these things are absolutely in crisis now. And I think that whether it's a decade from now or two decades from now, we could be seeing a substantial crisis in the art market, because I think one thing I've noted is that new media art is not really selling. You don't go into people's homes and see new media art on their TVs, on their HDTVs, or on the wall. And you know, I see art on people's walls, and they have amazing HDTVs. I have a 46-inch one. I could pirate work. I know where to go to get Bill Viola's, to get Damien Hirst. But I just, for some reason, I don't do it. It's not even a question of feeling like I shouldn't. It's a question of somehow it would be insipid or wrong, and I'm very puzzled by that. Something is happening within art that is essentially undoing the kind of art market that developed in the 18th century. And that's something I think we need to really address and deal with in terms of these issues of rights. But finally, as we're talking about this, I'd like to just finish with this image back to the 18th century. This is called the Statute of Anne. And if you were to ask me what we should do with the issue of digital rights, the Statute of Anne was enacted in 1710, and it gave publishers a 14-year term, renewable once if the author was still alive. The legal scholar Larry Lessig has pointed out repeatedly that if Walt Disney were to make the movies of the 50s, like Cinderella and Snow White and so forth, he would have to actually pay, today, he would have to pay the Brothers Grimm licensing fees. Because the big corporations like Disney have made it impossible for us to use that work in the public domain. That work is now, you know, quite old. It's over 50 years old in some cases. If you ask me what to do, I would suggest, you know, at least temporarily until we figure things out, just go back to the Statute of Anne and then say, okay, litigate the hell out of people who violate it. But at least, you know, there'd be some logic, as opposed to now we have the situation where we live in a culture where we're violating, you know, these principles regularly, and there's a bit of lawlessness about it that I don't necessarily think is too healthy, coupled with, you know, a constant fear. You know, well, is it possible that, you know, the big, you know, Philip Morris, you know, is going to annihilate an artist one day? Maybe not, but Walt Disney could. And these are real issues that that have real consequences. And right now, the way that copyright is set up is it really protects the big corporations and it doesn't protect the artist. So with that.
Great, thank you, Kazis. Thomas, maybe if you'd like to say a few words.
In the meantime, until the technician gets it going, as far as I know, you're saying that about the copyright thing. It's probably interesting to know that the 70 years span after the death of the author has been actually generated. No, stop, sorry. Stop it. It's fine. I do it. Just let me do it. Okay. It's going back to Wagner, the heirs of Wagner. And as the wife of Wagner was very close to the daughter of Wagner, I think it was the daughter, was very close to the Nazi government, they made a law which kind of basically secured the income for the whole family in Bayreuth. And it has been taken over by the whole world because the copyright laws have been internationalized. So it is a weird law, but it has a interesting origin. And I'm going back to roughly the same time when I heard about this talk. I thought, like, okay, it's probably going into the direction of music. On one hand, it's going to go into the direction of the sampling as a music. You know, we basically know it from the earliest on, I guess, from sampling in the 80s when you can do that. And I'd like to talk about the work I did last year, which actually shows a musical instrument. It's called the Heldenorgel. And how do I stop this thing? I just don't want to. Sorry. Oh, damn it. So it's a musical instrument. It's called the Heldenorgel. It's kind of has been built in Kufstein in Austria, on the rock. Privately funded by war veterans of the. We're talking about nostalgia here. War veterans of the First World War. And they finally got all the money together to kind of commemorate the losses and the comrades which died in the First World War in Austria and in south of Germany. So it doesn't have a political impact at all. It is pre-Nazi, but it opened in 1931 when the money was together. It's the biggest outdoor organ in the world. And it's sitting on this rock and basically plays the same song every day at noon, which is the song of the old comrade, which is a kind of an old war folky song, but it is not brutal and it's not party politics or it's not a politically coined song. So basically what happens there is that they decided to have, instead of a monument like the Trafalgar Square monument or whatever, or somebody a bronze on a horse or whatever would be the figurative metaphor, they said, we have to perform it. We perform the song every day and it is something which kind of carries you through and which, you know, like, has to be done on a daily basis. So basically it's like a little bit like memory. Memory is not something you have in a drawer. It's something you have to construct every day. Every time you just, if I say Lady Di's Tunnel in Paris, your brains are going to go and just put the puzzle pieces together. We know all that is kind of brain, you know, the neuroscientists kind of talking about, but not much more than that, how much we construct memories for ourselves instead of, you know, relying on them. So it's a very, very soft reservoir of your own ideas and memories you have. They realized that, and I found this very modern in a sense, that you just have to actually perform it every day. So they played this song. There was an organist and just doing that one song every day. And I got the postcard of that, the previous picture. I got the postcard from a friend of mine, Tacita Dean, And I wondered, and I found other postcards on that thing. I went to the place. These are the other postcards. The first one is the postcard we had. I was working on a show at the National Gallery in Berlin at the moment, which was actually about, you know, what are the ideas of the country we're living in made of? Private memories, you know, the pictures we share, any kind of, you know, things which come up when we talk about, like, if you talk about Britain, you know, we have a couple of Henry V, probably. If you talk about Germany in the last 20 years, we have the wall coming down. Huge fights, law cases actually were running about the one soldier jumping across the fence because that has been re-photographed and the original photographer kind of sued basically everybody quoting that thing. It's getting very interesting copyright rights to kind of find out what is actually, when it becomes a copy of that original photograph and how far you have to alter the whole idea. It turns out it's the gesture. You have to take, you know, you have to change the gesture. If you the Christian Keeler, the famous photographer, she sits on the chair. If somebody sits on a chair like this, naked, the gesture is a copyright violation already. Anyways, coming back to this organ, I found these things. I contacted the people, the organist. I finally found the organist, and I call her up and say, look, I would like to see that thing, if possible, and find out because nobody knows about that place. And it's on the border of between Germany and Kufstein. So basically, when you kind of climb the mountains there at 12 o'clock, you can hear the song from like a huge, massive thing. It's not a show thing. It's actually not something to look at because it's sound is all what's kind of important about that. It sits on the top right in this round building there. You see downstairs the keyboard is being played on a square building there. It's all, you know, and then it goes up with pipes to the thing. So when she plays a tone, it kind of takes 33 seconds until it's up there. It's all hydraulics or something. So she doesn't play the song at the time it is. It's just complete exercise every day. I called this lady and I asked her, can I see the organ in thing? And she says, you know, it's really weird you're saying this because they're turning, you know, that was a Friday. They actually taking it down on Tuesday. After 80 years, consecutive kind of operation, even throughout the war, they decided to kind of computerize it because, you know, the organists, they wanted to make a tourist attraction out of it. And a tourist attraction is a very different thing from a war memorial, really. I mean, even if the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin is pretty much the same idea, same place for doing two different things. However, this one is clearly about the memorizing, you know, dead people from like 100 years ago. So she said, I'm not going to sit in the, if you would have seen her, like, you know why, but like she didn't want to be a tourist attraction sitting there and doing Liberace on the keyboard for the tourists. So she refused. The mayor, keen for the money coming into Kufstein, he said, okay, then, you know, we do it computerized, we do it like a machinery, so like a robot. So she said, if you want to see it, you have to go now, come immediately. And I came immediately, and this is the organ as it has been built, the original 31 organ. And I found it amazing to see this instrument, which is completely different from the organs you know from churches, which are always about being seen. This is just an instrument. And it somehow reminded, I thought it was actually in the complexity of it and the scale, the jumping of the scale, plus the very simple but yet rather complex, which I had to find out, rather complex shapes. It is also resembling an army in a sense. So I started redoing this piece. Basically, whilst they were dismantling the whole thing, I just rebuild it. And in that sense, I think, you know, you see details of the making, or not the making, but from the organ. And I thought that, you know, like this kind of it's not a reenactment, but like they're basically like trying to kind of do something with that imagery, which is disappearing, would probably be making it into a monument for a monument. And as if you know my work at all, you see that very often I'm trying to kind of, I'm employing tautological circles for my work. So a piece of paper is a piece of paper is a piece of paper, and in a bit more indirect and abstracted way, I thought rebuilding this organ with like 4,500 tubes would be probably a fair kind of way of dealing with that memorative thing. That's the final picture, and I think that's all I wanted to say at this point.
Thank you. Geeta, we've been talking mostly about these issues of sampling and copyright in an art context and new media context too. Maybe if you could say a few words about these kind of things from a music background.
Absolutely. So it's become very fashionable in the last 15 years or so, especially in the 1990s, to talk about remixing, sampling, mashups, and so on in the Academy. But for various reasons, these terms can have a totally different resonance in music, especially in dance music, where terms like remixing and sampling have been common currency for so long. But these terms are even older than dance music, or, you know, disco or hip-hop or whatever you want to talk about. Take classical music, for example. Brahms' First Symphony borrowed phrases from Beethoven. Mahler borrowed from Brahms' First Symphony in his Third Symphony. And if you want to go further, you can say, well, you know, many classical composers also appropriated various themes from folk music. For example, Brahms had a whole series of Hungarian folk dances. He didn't write those themes necessarily, but he built upon them. Stravinsky once said, a good composer does not imitate, he steals. And we can also look at other forms of classical music. For example, in Indian classical music, nobody owns the raga. The different ragas for the different times of day, the one for the morning or the one for nighttime, they're these common forms that everybody plays and everybody has their own spin on. You can go even more elemental, and the musician Saul Williams, among others, has said that the Bible is a remix. It's sampled from all these different sources. It cuts and pastes from all these different areas, from all these different versions. And so we've always been doing this. It's just that I think in the past, we didn't pass them off as something that had been sampled and remixed. We just said, this is the thing, this is the Bible, or this is whatever. And to bring it back to music and to hip-hop and dance music, which is what I'm going to talk a bit about, I find it interesting that people are still, you know, I think sampling is a very appealing thing to talk about among an academic group, because it brings all of these theoretical ideas and all of these things that are very interesting to unpack and think about. In the world of popular music right now, we're no longer in a world where dense, heavy, sample-based collage music is the norm, for various reasons. Sample-based hip-hop records are now the preserve of the very, very rich. If you're Kanye West, Timbaland, Dr. Dre, that's one thing. If you're not, it's very, very hard to pay for an album that samples James Brown, P-Funk, or so on. And the average cost of a sample right now is about $10,000. So if you have a whole lot of samples in your record, you do the math, it adds up. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about one of my favorite groups of all time, Public Enemy. So Public Enemy never cleared all of the samples for their classic records. It Takes a Nation of Millions, Fear of a Black Planet. And it is partially for this reason, and there was a very interesting article in The Guardian last week that talked about this. There have been no major hip-hop reissue box sets the same way there have been, say, Beatles box sets or other classic rock box sets. No massive multi-disc retrospective spanning 20 discs. No voluminous liner notes, humongous deluxe reissues with outtakes and whatever for Public Enemy or De La Soul or any of these classic hip-hop groups. Part of the reason is to do these kinds of reissue projects, you'd have to go back and actually clear all of those samples, which nobody wants to do. The copyright scholar Kembru McLeod has estimated that the cost of clearing the samples in Fear of a Black Planet alone would be $5 per album. So for a platinum-selling album, that would be $5 million to clear the samples on Fear of a Black Planet. Now, let me play you a song just to illustrate for those of you who may have never heard Public Enemy, though I think everybody here has. Here's... I guess it's not... It was playing. There we go.
Burn, Hollywood, burn. I smell a riot going on. First they're guilty, now they're gone. Yeah, I'll check out a movie, but it'll take a black one to move me.
So a song like that, and I mean, I just to this day find Public Enemy's production style so incredibly interesting, is that just even a drum track alone could involve like 12 to 15 samples. Everything Public Enemy did was cobbled together in this very, very minute way from thousands of samples. It's on an atomic level. If you look at these tracks, it's so interesting. And the way that it built up the sound, there are all these folk stories of things like Hank Shockley, like, jumping up and down on vinyl records because he didn't think they sounded dirty enough to sample, you know, and then he'd sample from them or whatever. They had such an incredible sound. It was like a hornet's nest. It was like the angriest sound in the world. But it was built like sedimentary rock, you know, from all these incredible layers and layers of sound. Another problem is that in the 80s, hip-hop, it wasn't really recognized still that hip-hop was a big moneymaker. In the early 1990s, it became extremely obvious that hip-hop was this huge moneymaker and that you could sue and get all of this money from uncleared samples. The other tragic thing that happened is that, for example, George Clinton was sued for sampling himself because George Clinton does not own the rights to his own music. His music is owned by a sort of semi-sinister corporation called Bridgeport, who sued him for sampling himself. And the minute that that they got the rights to that back catalog, they did something like they sued almost like 800 different people for sampling P-Funk and collected, you know, millions and millions of dollars. There was a key court case in 1991 involving Biz Markie in which the judge actually invoked the Bible and said, "Thou shalt not steal." And after the Biz Markie case in 1991... it's been a huge problem, much more of a problem, to sample legally in hip hop. And so the music that's pushing sort of the outer limits of dance music right now, can talk about dubstep, which has become wildly popular in London and elsewhere, the wilder fringes of techno. A lot of these people aren't really relying very heavily on sampling anymore. The incredible kinds of restrictions that have been placed on sampling in this era has forced musicians to kind of think of different ways of, say, making hip hop, for example. And I'm going to play you a track produced by the Neptunes. And the Neptunes became emblematic of a new sort of minimalism, a very kind of spacey, spare sound that not only became very cool in hip-hop, but in other genres as well. And this song is by the Clips. It's called Grindin'.
Yo, yo. I go by the name, of Pharrell. The Neptunes, and I just wanna let y'all know,
I'm your pusher.
The world is about to feel something that
I'm
they never
pusher.
There's a lot of emptiness in that sound. It's a very kind of hollow much more minimalist sort of sound. There are producers today that are using samples, but they tend to do it in a different way. For example, there is an artist in London right now. He's only 22 years old. His name's James Blake. And he uses a lot of samples in his music, but he obscures them to the point where you almost can't recognize where the sample came from. And I'll just play you a little clip of a track by him. So he gets this sort of ghostly traces, this sort of very, these shadows of samples. He has this very atmospheric way of working with samples. And some of those samples are pretty well-known samples that he uses in his music, but you can't really tell where the sample is from because they're obscured and filtered and messed with in so many different ways. While the technological tools have made it much, much easier to sample your favorite tune, it has become much, much harder to release it legally. Very few of the quote-unquote mashups that became very popular about 7 or 8 years ago now were actually released legally. Most were bootlegs. We even see these restrictions on YouTube where many fan-made videos like slash videos and tribute videos have been pulled by huge corporate entities like Warner. So the hand that gives is the hand that takes away. I'm not convinced that music has suffered for it necessarily. It has grown and mutated and gone well beyond the sampledelic sounds of the 80s and early 90s. Or it takes the concept of sampling in a different direction. Drum and bass, for example, was a genre that was built and born around essentially one sample, which I will play for you now. That 6-second sample was the genesis of a whole genre of music. It spawned whole cities, entire ecosystems surrounding this one sample. So that's a completely different way of thinking about the sample. And that's the amen or amen break from a little-known song by the Winstons called Amen or Amen, My Brother. And so I think that it was a sample like this is a germ of an idea. It's a roadmap for an entire musical evolution. And the music of the future, I think, will take its inspiration in much the same way. We will use these tiny echoes of past sounds, these tiny bits and pieces, and construct entire cities around them. And we'll magnify them and blow them up. And that's all I have to say right now. I'll take questions later or whatever.
Thank you. Geeta, you were mentioning the mashup singles that were released, you know, popular maybe 6 or 7 years ago now. And they were, for the most part, pretty much novelty kind of hits, right? You know, splicing together The Strokes or Christina Aguilera. But there was that one guy who made albums, Girl Talk, his name, Greg Gillis, I think. And he had no way of clearing all of the samples because each album comprised something like 200 different songs. And so what he did was just release it. But then I think there was actually different cases of CD pressing factories not pressing the album. They're actually refusing to. iTunes like ultimately pulled it from the iTunes store. But his argument was always that something like this would never weaken the market for the original tune. I mean, in most cases, he'd probably strengthen it, for example. So I was kind of really wondering, like, where on what criteria do you think the entertainment industry is justifying this kind of approach? Because it is quite difficult to prove, I think, that something like that is going to really weaken anything, you know?
Well, I think that one really key problem is that the music industry believes that the law doesn't... there's no difference between copying 1 second or 30 seconds of a recording. So, like, record companies insist that basically, like, absolutely everything must be cleared. It doesn't matter if you're sampling 1 second of something or if you're sampling a minute of something, but absolutely everything must be cleared. Like, the RZA from Wu-Tang Clan has said that back in the days when they were putting out the first Wu-Tang records, the cost of clearing an average sample was something like $2,500. It's now ballooned to $10,000. So for a smaller kind of indie record, you know, your whole budget for putting out your record might be $30,000. If you have 3 samples on that record, that's your whole budget right there. So I think a part of it is the overzealousness of the music industry. Another problem, I think, also, bringing it a little bit back to the art, the visual art world, is that, you know, a lot of artists were sued. Rauschenberg was sued. Jeff Koons was sued. Warhol was sued. But a lot of these guys settled out of court. And because they settled out of court, for example, like, when Rauschenberg was sued for clipping something and putting it in one of his collages and then someone found it and sued him, he gave that guy $3,000 out of court and a copy of the piece, which is probably now completely, you know, millions and millions of dollars. However, because they settled out of court, they didn't establish legal precedents, which we could have used today to defend ourselves against these new cases. In the same way that happened with music, these key court cases, there were a few. One involved 2 Live Crew, who some of you might remember, and that actually ended up in 2 Live Crew's favor. And then there was that one big court case with Biz Markie, but you know, a lot of other cases have been sort of settled out of court, or the legal precedents that have been established have not necessarily been good ones, and so it's been a very difficult area, I think, to navigate for that reason.
Kazis, you were talking about SolarWit certificates at some point, and I don't know if you've seen the project that Superflex did earlier in the year called Free SolarWit Eindhoven. Yeah. I was wondering, kind of, a lot of the artists we were talking about to begin with, people of that Pictures generation of Richard Prince and so on, they were kind of navigating, you know, a certain kind of production model, right, in terms of they're looking to advertising. It was kind of then current. And I was wondering if you would like to maybe say a few more words about artists, people like Superflex, who are navigating copyright things these days. Someone like Seth Price is someone who's written a bit about this too.
Yeah, I mean, I think I could do 2 things. One's follow up a little bit on what Gita was just saying, and then also respond to that in one go. To begin with what Guido was saying, there's one of the problems we're having with these court cases is that because we live in this extremely neoliberal, corporate-loving world in the EU and the US, where, you know, corporations get really whatever they want, and any idea of a social compact is thrown away in favor of the rights of the individuals go away in favor of the rights of the corporations, they are, you know, these precedents aren't even really standing up in certain ways. Like, you could look at... there was a court case in the late 1950s suggesting that any kind in the U.S. that was very influential, I'm sorry, it's terrible memory, don't remember the precise name of the court case, but it was basically a court case said that even a bad copy of a text, that is, even a just Xeroxing something badly would be enough to distinguish it from the original, okay? So I could take a Richard Prince and I could just reproduce it, well, let's say digitally, and that's it, and I own it. And yet these things are being overwritten. these things are being changed through massive, massive amounts of corporate money. And there's nothing, there's very little that, you know, we have organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, we have Larry Lessig. We aren't able to do enough to fight this. And I think it is a big issue, and it's only going to get worse. That said, coming back to both what you're saying and to why these corporations are doing this, one of the other things that's happening is we do live in a culture of copying. So if you look at, and this crisis of value I'm talking about has hit the music industry incredibly hard. I mean, the music industry is collapsing. I mean, there's just no question that the labels are losing money hand over fist. And this might not, you know, turning to eating their own children, essentially, by, you know, litigating against sampling is perhaps a bit bizarre. And it smacks of this kind of thing that goes on a lot in computer software, where companies hold patents that they do not employ. They buy up patents, and then they exist to sue other companies. So Apple Computer has just been sued, for example, not by such a company, but by a Yale professor for using what actually is a very simple idea, I think. And we're going to get, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And this might be the future. You know, this future of buying things up and suing. I think it's already there, as we said in music with his Bridgewater rights. Now, in terms of these artists, again, it points to both ways. I mean, you're right to point out Superflex's Free Solowitz works, which was this project of very careful negotiation and working with the rights and really, I think, something of a kind of, you know, in a sense, a revisitation of, well, some other conceptual art strategies that might have existed back in at the time of Lewitt, that involves, again, you know, legal issues and negotiations with Lewitt's widow and so forth. But it points to one issue, which is how do you value the Superflex work? How do you give value to it? Again, in terms of turning back to maybe or turning. Seeing some kind of transition from a fluid but still stable system of copyright that existed from the Statute of Anne until sometime into the 90s, we're also seeing this issue of value. You know, artists did not make money the way they did under modernity and under the 19th century, before the 18th century. You had patrons who supported you. And, you know, many of the relational artworks that exist today, many of the this kind of works, like the kind of projects of Superflex, many of these projects that are new media driven, really exist on a kind of institutional model of patronage that does not really work very well with an art market. And perhaps I'm wrong. You know, perhaps those of you who actually know this better can point to examples, and please do, because then I'll learn something. But my sense is that is a problem for these kind of works, and we're seeing this. You know, do you want to be tied to institutions who themselves might be, in the end, a bit fragile? I mean, you know, not that one necessarily wants to live in the market, but, you know, does one also always want to deal with just a kind of institutional model of patronage of the museum and the university as being one's sponsors? And so I think that's, again, crucial, is how can you sell that work? What mm-hmm. can you do with it?
And Thomas, your own work often starts with an image, and you often kind of go back to the source with that. And we were talking earlier, Gita mentioned someone like James Blake in the music context is really obscuring the sample to get around some of these issues. I was wondering, with your own work, when you then remake it and then photograph that, whether you've ever come up against any kind of friction in terms of working with an image that perhaps comes from the Press Association, I'm guessing.
No.
Okay. Did you expect to, or do you kind of find that, was that something that you were pushing against, the fact that you were working for? I mean, how important is the fact that the image that you're working from is something that is sourced online, it's something that is encountered in that way?
There are a couple of aspects to what has been said before and to this question, which is, one of them, we're talking about the art market, but we're talking also about artworks. So if Superflex is doing a free Solowitz, they're depending on something Solowitz did, very openly. So there is an artistic creation, and the artistic creation is the starting point, and that gets forgotten. We're talking about markets, we're talking about selling, we're talking about buying. And I have a little bit the feeling, I mean, I don't have a theory here, but like I have a feeling you can't have both. You know, you cannot say, oh, art is for everyone and everybody should have this. And I show my paintings in the internet and it's going to be the same. And I'm happy if everybody can see it. And if you want to completely a mass market and you want to compete with Disney, then, you know, then, but you don't have the machinery of Disney, then you might be running into trouble. You cannot expect to do both at the same time. The show in Monaco I did, I can tell you, one of the biggest pleasures of curating a show with like 18 artists and 130 artworks was having these Magrits there, because the value, talking about value, the value of a Magrit is, I don't know, 16, 17 million or something. And you just pick it up and you should look at it and you turn it around, and as a curator you can do, which I can never do otherwise. And you have to realize these things are crazy in the terms of they absolutely crazy objects, because I cannot think of anything else in the world, not even diamonds, which have like this weird, unrelated, you know, like misrepresentation of the object towards the value. It's paint, it's a painting. You can always say, you know, like I read this morning in The Guardian, for this hood of the car, I can buy a whole Mercedes. That's just the lamest and most idiotic kind of argumentation I can see. So the Magritte is, of course, much more than the paint and the frame, but it's also so incredibly fragile. And it's kind of the society provides us with the little pocket of, you know, attaching value, enormous value, more than a house. Like this is like 14 villas, and this is like I don't know how many yachts and stuff. It's this tiny little it's tiny little painting, and somebody decides that this is what we want. You know, I mean, we have to go back to the thing, to the object. I think the object is in the first place, and that the art market is not full of screens. You know, the art market is full of objects. You might buy a certificate, buy Solibit, but there's no point in having that if you don't perform it, in a sense. If you don't, you know, then it's just the market value, and it's really boring and trivial to talk about. You know, I mean, we can talk about money if you want, but this is not, there's much more to the whole thing, I think, you know, what was the original question?
My original question was the importance of, to you, for the fact that the image is out there, the fact that it's to be experienced online.
I mean, like a very famous gallerist also showing here said, told me once, we are in entertainment business. And I'm, you know, that might be the case, we are in entertainment business, especially on a panel like this, but actually I completely disagree. Art is not in the entertainment business. And if it's trying to compete with that technology, with that kind of the market technology, the market kind of rules and everything, it is a market at the same time, but the market is only a very small share of what artists do and what artists are concerned with. You know, we just completely forget this, that, you know, in the last 10 years, and this is kind of completely kind of going away from the point of sampling, in the last 10 years, auction houses, the market, everything has been taken over in figures. You know, the art is, in the first place, it's an idea, and it's a good idea, and sometimes it's an idea kind of coming from someone else's idea. It's all built up somehow, and we're always going to have these kind of struggles about who owns what or something, you know, because nobody comes from nowhere. However, I think, I don't know. I don't know what the point is in this discussion, really, for me to bring in, you know, with that, but it's just, I keep thinking that that it goes back to the artistic creation, and some artistic creation kind of relies on other people's work and some other doesn't. And, you know, like, and more clearly, and then you run into the risk of getting into that trouble, and others not. And as an artist, you have to decide, do you want to kind of go to the masses? Do you want, you have to work everywhere? I mean, I don't give interviews to everyone because it's not because I'm anti-democratic. It's just like I know that with some people I can communicate and they're going to be interested and they can understand what I'm talking about, and others don't. And, you know, there's only that much time you have, and so you probably, I don't know, that's completely off. No.
Because you were bringing up the Statute of Anne earlier, which seems to me, I mean, in relation to what Thomas has been saying, that was very much on the side of the market, as I understand it.
Yes, but the Statute of Anne also allowed, I mean, on the one hand, it was meant to It was meant to regularize a process of printing books, and it was meant to, on the one hand, guarantee that there would be returns to the publisher and to the writer for a set period of time, and then that this work would then be in the domain, so something could be done with it. And that leads to one question. I mean, I think Thomas is you're very right to bring up the issue of, you know, it's not all about the market. What about the artwork, which then curiously you're talking about as being so, the object as being so, so expensive now, and there's something kind of really mad about that, you know, $16 million for paint and canvas. And if we think about, you know, this idea of the hand and the originality and the genius that exists there and the inspiration that was there, again, if we go back, let's say historically, back to, let's say, the Renaissance or the Baroque era, we have a very different. There's a very different idea of inspiration today. Inspiration is what comes from within me, you know. And even I think if you ask Public Enemy, it's, you know, what comes from within them, you know. And yeah, we're getting this stuff and we're mixing it. And so, but back in those days, inspiration didn't mean that at all. Genius did not mean being original, but rather genius meant how one interpreted great themes, how one embodied the spirit of the divine spirit, the spirit of the genre one worked in, the school one worked in, and even the patron, you know, one who one worked for. And so the artist, the idea of an artist was, or a writer, was a much more fluid idea rather than saying that this was, you know, everything stemmed from within here or here, the heart or the head. It really stemmed from a question of outside. And that's a different, I think that's a different idea than the one we have today. And again, points to, and yet some of those works, you know, those are works that are untouchable now, right? Those are works that don't even circulate in the market, basically, when you think of the works of the Renaissance, just because they're so profoundly expensive. I wonder if, you know, and what I'm saying is, I wonder if in already, if that's disappearing a little bit among a younger generation of individuals. I wonder if, like, the idea of genius, the idea of inspiration is becoming something else. I wonder if we're seeing some transitions. I wouldn't be surprised if we are. In fact, I'd be surprised if we're not. I think that future generations, or even the current generation that's in art schools and coming out, is going to be looking at, they might not even care about the market. They might not care about institutional support. We might see some very different ideas of what it is to be an artist emerging, I think.
I think that's probably a good place to move to questions from the floor. There's a roaming microphone. If you could just wait for that before asking your question. Someone just over there.
That was quick. I guess I was wondering if, do emerging standards like Creative Commons licensing play a role in this? Is there something to be said for these ideas of something less than all rights reserved copyright, especially as we see more and more work being published on the internet? I was just wondering if that idea had a place in this conversation at all. Creative Commons licensing, that is.
Creative Commons licensing has been a real boon, I think, in terms of images and music on the internet, but it has a long way to go. I mean, I think that we're just at the beginning of what licenses like Creative Commons mean. I think it was a very important step, but, you know, Creative Commons licensing isn't going to help, you to put out a hip-hop record with 300 samples on it, most likely. So I think that, yeah, it definitely has its place in this conversation, and it's definitely a very important thing, but it's unclear to me how it could help in the sort of problems that the music industry is currently having.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that Creative Commons, I think, has... is very powerful, and it's, you know, it's led to, I do a lot of photography that I put up, some of which I put up with a Creative Commons license, and I had a very wonderful record label contact me with asking if I would use, they would could use one of my photographs for the cover, and they said, you know, send me a CD. And beautiful classical minimalist composer who whose work I'm very honored to be on the cover of. I got a CD for it. That was fine. I never expected to make a penny for this photograph. I have a different economic model for the work I do. It's university supported. And so it was a delight. But yeah, I mean, it's on the other hand, that said, there's again a certain kind of value issue there for a world of stock photographers who, you know, made a great deal of money off of selling their photographs. They have seen their livelihood disappear, or at least become radically reduced. Stock photography is now something that it's harder and harder to make money from as a career. So, and partly Creative Commons licensing is to deal with that, because you can, if you want to use an image in a newspaper or a news magazine, and you would pay rights for it, and you write somebody and you say, I'll give you Creative Commons for it, you know, like, hey, I'm in the newspaper, sure, why not? So it helps and it doesn't help.
Are there any more questions? In which case, I think we'll wrap it up then. I'd like to thank my panel, Thomas, Gita, and Kazis. Thank you.